Don't shout. Don't be hysterical. Don't be dramatic. Don't show me something. Trust the play and have a conversation.
That's Joseph Ziegler, one of Canada's most accomplished actors and directors, sharing the advice he learned from Robin Phillips, who is directing Ziegler in a production of Hamlet. It's just one of the many insights about acting you'll hear in today's podcast. These days, Joseph Ziegler is a regular at the Stratford Festival and Toronto Soul Pepper, the theater company he helped to create. I spoke with Ziegler at the Young Center for the Performing Arts, where he was rehearsing for The Last Wife. The play sold out in Stratford and is now on stage in Toronto until February 11th. My interview with Joseph Ziegler is coming right up. Hey, it's Keith Tomasek. Thanks so much for listening to The Inadequate Life, a podcast about the creative process and people whose lives depend upon it, brought to you by StratfordFestivalReviews.com. First off, I have to say thanks for all the great feedback I've been getting on iTunes, the reviews. You can just leave a review and I'm getting them. Thanks, I appreciate it. And I have to apologize to one listener who sent me a voice message about how much she enjoys the podcast. Thank you so much. Unfortunately, I accidentally deleted the audio message you left. So if you're that woman from Australia, currently living in Montreal, who enjoys the podcast and sent an audio message, forgive me. I heard it, I got a kick out of it, and then I deleted like a ton of emails and the file was attached to the email. So I'm really super sorry. Hey, anyone can reach out to me. It's just easy as this. Visit theinadequatelife.com, hit the Say Hello tab. You can leave an email or a voicemail. And I promise I will not delete your message. Hey, by the way, next episode coming up, Sandra Shamus. She's on stage right now at Harborfront, a great new show. I had a chance to talk to her just before that show opens, so stick around because that's going to be the next episode next time around. Before we get to my chat with Joseph Ziegler, I want to thank my sponsors, Karen Hartwick over at Stratford Tea Leaves. Been with me since day one. She was just in Toronto this weekend for the Toronto Tea Festival, where her chakra teas were a big hit. Now, a chakra tea is a unique blend of teas that Karen put together, and each individual blend helps balance one of your chakras. How cool is that? So, if you're anywhere near Stratford, book a tea tasting or drop in to experience the world's best, freshest, and most exotic loose leaf teas with Karen Hartwick, Canada's tea sommelier. And of course, my new sponsor, Daylight, the productivity app exclusively for Mac, iPhones, and iPads. Daylight is used by musicians, composers, and artistic agencies. It helps them organize all the business stuff. So whether you're running a side hustle or a full-time creative business, Daylight can organize all of your contacts, emails, projects in one app. You don't have to remember who to follow up with tomorrow because Daylight does that for you. Creative entrepreneurs all over the world use Daylight to grow their businesses. Visit marketcircle.com/daylight to start a 30-day free trial. And don't forget to mention you heard about it on The Inadequate Life, and you'll get 50% off your first month subscription. That's marketcircle.com/daylight. Okay, now for the interview with Joseph Ziegler. I have to tell you, there's a lot going on here. He's seen a ton of stuff in his days in the theater. So anyone interested in acting or directing or that creative process, you're going to learn a ton. I even learned a bit about parenting. So settle in. One thing I have to tell you, halfway through the interview, you're going to hear a startling scream in the background. It's a really chilling scream. But I can assure you no actors were harmed in the making of this podcast. It was just a rehearsal. Remember, Joseph Ziegler is currently on stage in The Last Wife at the Young Center for the Performing Arts in Toronto's Distillery District, and it's the same cast that played the sold-out houses in Stratford, and it's a fabulous show.
I put out on Facebook that I was going to be talking to you, and a couple of people had some questions for you, so I just want to read you those questions, all right? So here's the first one. This is from Grant. Grant says, I was a bartender at the Shaw Festival when Joseph Ziegler made his first appearance there alongside Norm MacLellan in Brecht's A Respectable Wedding.
Yeah.
That was in 1980. No question for him, but do pass on my congratulations on over 30 years of quality work in Canadian theater.
That's very kind, yeah.
Isn't that something, eh?
Yeah, it is.
30, and was it Nora's first year as well?
I think it was her first year at the Shaw Festival. Chris Newton, that was Chris's... Was it his first year? I think it was Chris's first year there. And there were a lot of people that had been working in Vancouver that came with him to Ontario. They're still here.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of wonderful actors that were out there. And we did this crazy, respectable wedding.
Hmm. Okay. Any comments on that show itself or not necessarily?
Yeah, no, respectable wedding was an amazing piece of theater done by director Derek Goldby, who took Brecht's idea, which is a kind of a sketch. It's like a one-act sketch, the play. And he just exploded it. And it's Brecht's look at what he felt was a sort of bourgeois convention of weddings and what they meant and how people react to them and how sometimes true meaning in life and true passion gets bypassed by conventional
for sure, yeah.
things. So
the title of the podcast, The Inadequate Life, is a quote from Brecht. It's the full quote is, "Fear not death, but rather the inadequate life." And to me, I chose that title because it sort of speaks, I think, as to the creative experience. And I actually teach Brecht. I teach a class on social media at the University of Western Ontario. And one of the first things I have them read is called A Manifesto on Radio, written by Brecht in the 1930s.
Wow.
And he talks about radio as an amazingly powerful tool. And he's critical of the people who used radio back then, because a lot of it was sort of reminiscent of entertainment in vaudeville. It wasn't really thought-provoking. And yes. It wasn't really consequential, is the word he uses. It was not very consequential. And it's amazing because he foreshadowed the power of radio, which is what Hitler used to draw his
of course
power. Yeah, Brecht is such a I don't know if I was gonna say undervalued person, I don't know, but anyway, I always enjoy
we have begun to take him for granted quite
I
a
think
bit
that's a good point. Yeah,
he's there. His plays are startling and shocking if only we take the time to go through them carefully and unearth what he's written.
Yeah.
They're remarkable.
And that's what I have to do with my students with this manifesto on radio. It's not an easy read, and it scares some of the students away. The social media, what the hell is this? Talking about politics and radio and powerful elites. And I'm like, no, this is really important because the internet has all that power as well. And
for sure.
And for the most part, hasn't, you know, there's been drips and drabs. Okay, here's another question from Zach. It's talking about politics, coincidentally. Have recent political events south of the border provided any parallels with some of the themes of this play, The Last Wife, and in particular, the role of Henry?
That's a good question. I was thinking about that, too. I think that you can't help but think of Trump a bit with this play, because Henry is not modern in terms of his feeling about women. Women are objects. Women are something that are there to satisfy men. That's the whole point. And he meets Catherine Parr, who is a kind of a modern woman in the sense that she feels that a woman should control her own destiny. She thinks that a woman has a right to her own opinions. And so the dialogue between them is remarkable. The play goes on after Henry is gone, but where Catherine Parr and Henry get to by the end of their time together is he is mystified by her. He doesn't understand her. I mean, that's been part of the thing. He admires her and respects her and puts her in a position of sort of power at the end of the play, or at the end of their relationship together. But he doesn't understand her. And I think that's a wonderful thing in Kate Henning's writing, is that Catherine Parr was ahead of her time. And how could a guy like Henry be expected to? What he did do was appreciate her. So he made her regent at a time when he went over to fight in France. And he, at the end of the play, he leaves her in charge of a council of 16 people. Anyway.
So the beginning part relates to Trump in terms of objectification of women.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that's partly what I get in all this American, in the American election, is not understanding what individuals are about, categorizing people, feeling that people are either with you or against you, or they're bad or they're good. Yeah. And it's life is so much more complex than that. And, I feel like in the play, Henry is at times a bit of a bully, and because he doesn't understand Catherine Parr, they have conflict about various things, and his method of resolving the conflict is can be pretty violent, can be pretty drastic, is not about words, is not about talking it
through. It's about imposing his will in a very masculine way, which I don't know. Maybe I'm judging Trump wrongly, but that's kind of what I get when I listen to him. I think, you know, with his his insistence on this wall, you know, between America and Mexico, you just think that's insane. This is the 21st century. We could probably come up with something better.
The 21st century. Exactly. Let's go back to coal and automotive assembly plants. Yeah, it is the 21st. I haven't heard him use anything progressive. Oh, no, we're getting political. Okay, so we're going to move away from politics. This is from Carol. Which is his all-time favorite role? I have seen most of them, and I'm curious. Thanks for everything, Mr. Ziegler.
How kind. That's amazing. I have to say, I love the classics. I love doing Shakespeare. I came from Minneapolis. That's where I was born and I grew up. But I came to Canada to learn how to do Shakespeare because of Michael Langham running the Guthrie. And I saw his plays and I thought, man, a lot of the people there were from the National Theatre School. So I went to the National Theatre School. And anyway, I've been here ever since. I love doing Shakespeare. When we did Death of a Salesman here a few years ago.
Here in Soulpepper?
In Soulpepper, yeah. While we were rehearsing it and working on it, it suddenly occurred to me, this is a perfect play. It's an amazing play. And if I have to pick a favorite, I would have to say playing Willie Loman might have been my favorite because it was such a startling play, such a shocking play. And it was shocking to perform it. And then doing all my sons last year at Stratford was fantastic, and I love doing it. I don't think it's as great a play, but it's as the vision is as great.
Yeah.
So I don't know, and because I'm American and from the Midwest, and I guess I kind of relate to that stuff pretty well.
Yeah, I didn't see the production here of Death of a Salesman, but one of the most influential and most memorable things I've ever seen was Guy Sprung's production of Death of a Salesman at Stratford so many years ago.
Yes, yeah.
And I remember we went with the school tour, I sat in the back row, I cried. And I just remember being just drawn right into the moment, you know. That's interesting. So despite the interest in Shakespeare, it would really come down to that.
Well, I guess so. I mean, it surprised me a lot because I had never thought of myself as being old enough to play that. I thought, I'm a young man. What are you talking about? But my friend Albert Schultz said, you know, I think you should do this play. And
how did that make you? How old were you when that happened?
I guess I was, maybe I was 59. When we first did it, we did it again a couple of years later.
When Albert brought that to you, and your perception was,
as I read it, I thought, okay, I can see this,
right?
I can see it happening, but it's not a role I had thought about for a long time. I had not grown up thinking I really want to play Willie Loman.
Yeah.
So it kind of took me by surprise. I mean, I really felt for the first time in a long time how American I am.
Oh,
and I think of myself as Canadian.
Sure, yeah.
But so much of that play, I was just, oh, that's all me. And my family is working class, and I never thought of myself as working class, but I am working class. That's who Willie Loman is. He's working class.
Absolutely,
and
yeah.
That's a big part of what Arthur Miller is writing about, is what happens when we take these people and use them up and toss them aside. That's one of the things he's getting at in the play. And I haven't felt like anybody's tossed me aside or anything or used me up, but I understood what he was talking about and I understood what he meant in a big way.
So that makes me think of what you're going to be doing at Stratford Timon of Athens, because isn't there a touch of shade of that as well?
Yeah, there's a lot to do with wealth and who has it and who doesn't have it. Timon has it. Timon has wealth at the beginning of the play, and by the end of the play, he doesn't. And what does that mean in the world, and how is he perceived in the world? He is worth, when he has no money, he is worth nothing.
Right, so that makes me think of the parallels with Death of a Salesman,
yeah,
and being tossed aside.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. I mean, in the case of Timon, he chooses to go away, and he chooses to go away from society because they have, as far as he's concerned, they've let him down.
Yeah. So let's go back to, because you mentioned the Guthrie.
I decided when I was 12.
Oh my goodness.
I was going to be an actor.
Oh wow. So what were you looking at in Minneapolis? No,
I was in many plays before I ever saw one. I was in school plays.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, I know.
So you had acted, but you hadn't gone to see
anything. And
now that makes complete sense as an actor. Because I never get the feeling that, I mean, this sounds silly, but I never get the feeling like you're acting.
Ah,
do you know what I mean?
That's a big compliment, but.
But that makes, because my kid has seen a ton of theater, but he's never acted yet, but I can tell he has this concept of what acting is.
Yeah.
Because he's seen so many pieces.
Yeah.
But the fact that you were acting before you'd seen what acting was supposed to be like, that, to me, that's really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. I my first thoughts about acting was that, wow, is this ever fun? And I think I was cast in plays in my school because I had such a loud voice. And
okay.
I don't really know, but I really liked it and I loved it. And then, but then I went on a school trip, I guess, to see Love's Labor's Lost.
Where was somewhere in Minneapolis?
Yeah, at the Guthrie Theater, directed by Michael Langham. And Love's Labor's Lost was a signature production of Michael Langham's. He directed it through his lifetime in Stratford, in New York, in Minneapolis.
And that's not an easy Chichester. Show for a young person to see.
No, that's right.
But
here's the thing. When I saw that play, I was probably 22,
I
understood every single word of it. 10 years after that, I was at the Stratford Festival, and I was cast in Love's Labor's Lost, directed by Michael Langham. And I started to read the play, and I understood none of it. So my understanding of the play was because his production was so lucid, so clear. It made everything available. And that's the way he directed it, too. So we didn't understand it, but we sat around the table with dictionaries and with books and everything we could find to help us until we understood
right.
the play.
Yeah.
So.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then what did your folks do? Because you said you're working class, right?
Yeah. Yeah. My mother brought up 6 kids and worked nonstop at home.
I'm sure.
And my father ran a factory in which they produced chemicals for cleaning dairy equipment. So he started there as the only worker. And by the time he was done, he was running the whole operation. He was a bit of an inventor. He invented everything, how to, make the equipment and all that. So I worked there a number of years while I was in university.
And how did they respond when you said, I'm going to Montreal? I just finished university.
Yeah.
And now I'm going to go to Montreal for this conservatory theater program.
Yeah. The thing is that I had said when I was 12 that I was going to be an actor.
Wow.
Yeah. So by the time I was 21 or 22, I guess I was 22 when I went to the National Theater School, it had been talked about for so long. They just accepted it.
Part of the way it was going to go.
Yeah. Yeah.
Huh, that's really nice. So your parents, as a parent, I'm always fascinated. So your parents never were worried about a life in the arts?
They were. Absolutely. Okay. Yeah, they were. Yeah. But they did. They just thought, let him go. He's got to do it.
You know? And did they get to see you achieve success?
Yeah. They're still here. They're still around. They haven't seen a play in a long time. They're 88 and traveling is a lot more difficult for them now. But we talk all the time.
So they know. They must be so proud, eh?
Well, I don't know. Yeah.
I don't know. Come on. Wow. And so another parent, just thinking about parents and kids, I took my wife and my son, we saw A Christmas Carol here.
Ah.
And it was wonderful.
Oh, thank you.
And this was what really struck me about the power of theater, because we'd seen the movie, right? Everyone watches the movie. But after the production here, you give the talk that you give about the local organization that you're
the stop, yes.
Yeah, that you're raising money for.
That's right, yeah.
And my son was moved by the play, but then when you made that talk, like, you weren't even finished, and he's like, give me some money, Dad, I want to, and he was like so excited, and not in a, and it was in a very empathetic way, you know, like he actually because of the play and then your specific talk about that organization. It just reminded me, we can sit at home and watch, the movie.
Sure.
And then just eat some chips.
Well, that's what theater does.
Mm-hmm.
It brings us out of ourselves,
Yeah, it was such a, but as a parent, to be reminded of the how it's inclusive and the talking about the stop, the organization and in the community right here, how we can help each other out.
Right.
Yeah. It was really beautiful.
Oh, I'm glad.
Yeah. And here we are in this beautiful theater and the library now that you helped found. Talk a bit about the process because when you talked about your father starting as just a guy working and then basically seeing it grow right away, I thought of you and your relationship here at Soul Pepper.
Yeah, no, I'm not actually that integral to Soul Pepper, but I guess maybe I have been over the years.
I think you have. I think you're being modest.
Yeah. Well, the idea for the company here was born in the young company at Stratford in the like 1987 and 1988. With Susan Coyne and Albert Schultz and Nancy Pock and Bill Webster, all these actors getting together. And I was not part of the young company then. I was in the Stratford company. And so we had been talking about it for a long time because in 1998, which is the first year that Soul Pepper started, there wasn't actually a theater in Toronto that was dedicated to doing classical plays.
It was the Mirvish era, or just the end of the Mirvish era, maybe.
Sure. Yeah. So
the Dubinsky / Mirvish era. That's right. What I'm thinking. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that was something that we really wanted to do. Also, to tell you the truth, you know, I loved acting in Stratford in the 80s and in Niagara on the Lake at the Shaw Festival as well. But I have a wife who also works in the theater, and she was working in film and she was working on stage and in TV. We were having kids and it was harder and harder to be out of town. So we needed to be in a place where we could both be working. You know, I mean, that's a big part of what it was. So we wanted to live in our city and bring up our kids here and work here at the same time. So,
we just did it. But you're back at Stratford. You're back at Stratford a lot now, though.
Yeah. I'm a little older than when we started. and the company is going in a younger direction now. So it makes sense that I go to Stratford, you know.
And how does that affect your life? Because you've got kids. Now, my guy's 10, so I was actually the primary caregiver. My wife's super busy. So when he was young, I was the primary caregiver. Mm-hmm. And recently, now that he's older and, you know, I don't have to be home. Well, I do it soon. I won't have to be home when he gets home from school and all that sort of stuff. And I'm thinking, oh, I'm going to have more free time. But then I'm thinking, oh, God, he's going to be a teenage boy. He probably needs me more than ever. I don't want to be away.
Yeah.
Talk a bit about your life and your wife, because two working actors choosing to have a family and bring them up in Toronto.
Sure.
Where the average person has a hard time getting by, right?
Yeah. Well, when I was a kid, my mother didn't work outside the house. She worked, as I said before, she worked like a dog inside the house, but she didn't work outside the house. Those days are kind of gone.
You can't do it anymore.
You just can't do it, especially Toronto has become such an expensive city. You have to figure out a way to live. And if you want to have kids, you have to figure out a way to do it. And, you know, that's just something that we never found one solution to anything. My wife, Nancy Pock, and I have been working in the theater and, you know, TV, you know, for over 30 years and bringing up kids. And, you know, there are times when it has been easier. But you just got to find a way to do it. That's all there is to it. If it means something to you, if it's important to you, you got to do it.
Yeah.
That's all. So,
was there ever moments when you thought you had made the wrong choice for your family at all?
You mean in terms of our profession?
Yeah. Well, just because because of the ups and downs.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. No, I never thought that, because in a way there was no choice. We were actors. You know, that's what we were. Yeah. And so the choice would be not to act or not to act, but it would be maybe Toronto isn't such a good idea after all. Maybe we should move somewhere else, you know.
No, and your point, and this is for the young people to listen, the more successful career actors that I've talked to who have made it through all the ups and downs, because it's feast and famine sometimes, they say that I never had a plan B.
Yeah.
There was no plan B. We just were going to go and let's do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess, that's the same with us. I mean, listen, when Nancy and I began in this profession, which was like we moved to Toronto in 79. Toronto is an easier city to live in It was easy. Like, our first apartment was $225 a month.
Right.
You know, and that was a very nice place at St. Clair and Bathurst.
Sure. Yeah.
Now it's different. My son is lucky to find a house for $700 a month plus utilities.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
So.
And what's your kids' perception of theater? Three of them growing up with parents in the theater. Do they like the theater where they're like, oh my God, I'm not getting involved in that?
Yeah. No, my oldest son, Tim, is in the Stratford Conservatory program now, and he's very happy, but it's not easy. You know, it's been really tough for him. My other sons happily are not in the theater. One of them is going to be beginning a new job here in Toronto as a, I don't know, sort of a recruiter for organizations looking for computer help.
Yeah.
And my other son runs a bar on Queen Street. Yeah.
Close to the theater.
Yeah. 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 I guess it is.
The bohemian sort of lifestyle.
Yeah.
Wow. I mentioned earlier when you were talking about beginning your acting and having never seen a play and then acting in plays, I just wanted to read you a couple of the reviews. And this is one of the things that this really struck me. So this is from Kelly Nestruck at the Globe and Mail. And this is a review from Diary of Anne Frank, which I saw and loved. Joseph Ziegler breaks every heart in the house as Father Otto Frank. He cracked mine when Mr. Frank was shown simply listening to music in a brief scene change. And then he cracked mine right open, coming on at the end to deliver the epilogue that explains why the diary so abruptly comes to an end. And it's the first part of that that I talked about earlier, where you just don't seem to be acting. When you were, it was in a scene change, just quietly listening to the music.
Yeah, what a big compliment. But I guess you have to find a place where the story can be heard. Not me in the story, but the story itself can be heard. So, you know, I'm thrilled that he had that reaction at that moment, but a lot of people could say, well, no, that's the play. And it is that, in fact, is the play. What we all have to do as actors is we have to figure out a way to get out of the way. We have to figure out a way to let the play be heard. And that can be tough.
Sure. And talk, because you've directed as well, talk a bit about, as a director, how you find those moments and how you have the confidence as a director to let that breathing room exist.
Yeah. I have to figure out, what did the author write? Why did she write it? What does she want it to do? Where is it supposed to go? How are we going to, you know, find out what the author meant and go for it? Otherwise, see, if I could write my own play, I would, but I can't. I couldn't write a play if my life depended on it.
That's interesting.
So I have to, I find plays that I believe in. I mean, that's what we all do. We find plays that we believe in and we commit to them. We go for them. Yeah. But I can't make the play about me. I have to make me about the play.
Yeah, you know, you're making it sound simple. And then as a director, is there anything do you have any techniques? Or is there anything you do when you're reading through the text to try and find those moments that are sort of invisible, but you bring to life, like that moment in the scene change?
Well, I do a lot of work at my house. It's a lot easier now because of the computer. But when I started directing, I didn't have a computer, and I just had, my dining room table was covered with atlases, maps, dictionaries, other resource books, so that I knew what every line meant. So I knew what every what we were talking about at any moment in the play. So that when I walk into the rehearsal hall, you have to know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
I don't mean as a director. I mean, as an actor, you have to know what you're talking about. You got to know what that means. You got to know why it was written. And if you don't know why, you've got to let it infiltrate and work on you. You see what I mean?
And what in your career, what's been one of the tougher roles for you to get your head into and understand, have that sort of holistic, that's probably a good word, holistic understanding of the world and the moment?
Well, I'll tell you an awful story.
This is what we want to hear.
Yeah. In 1987, I was understudy of Othello in Stratford.
I heard, and you went on.
Yeah, I had to go on. I did five performances, and it was horrible. And the reason, I wasn't in the production, but I volunteered to be the understudy because there were no actors of color in the company except Howard Rollins, who was playing Othello. And I thought, and I love the play Othello. And the language that Othello himself speaks is so amazing. I thought, oh, I'll do this, thinking that I would never go on, that I would never have to, but I did have to go on. And, it was terrible, but I learned a lot of things doing it. The first performance that we did, I was completely on adrenaline, as you can imagine. There were, a couple thousand people watching, and it was,
the running time was cut down by 5 minutes just because of the adrenaline.
15 minutes.
Oh, 15
minutes.
You're serious?
Yeah.
I just threw that out there.
No,
really?
No, we lost 15 minutes that
wow.
day.
You're not kidding.
But I was running, as I say, completely on adrenaline. And then the moment came to strangle Desdemona at the end of the play, and I was exhausted and I had nothing in me. I had nothing left at all. But I went out and I did the scene and I put my black hands onto the white pillow and left all kinds of makeup on the pillow, which was a little alarming. But I realized that I had never ever thought about killing somebody. this is the thing. When an actor is cast as Macbeth or Richard III or somebody who's a murderer, they may not be a murderer. Hopefully they're not a murderer. But in 4, 5, 6 weeks, that's what acting is about. You imagine, you put yourself in the place of, and I had never done that with Othello. So it taught me what rehearsal is about in a sense, what the stage is of, because had I rehearsed it, I would have thought, well, so killing someone, what does that mean? What does that feel like? How do I get the willpower to do that? Let alone the mechanics of smothering someone, holding a pillow on her and, So
you knew in that adrenaline rush of the first performance backstage, did you know it was no good or did you?
Oh, I knew it was awful from the time I got the phone call saying, Joe, get down here. Oh, I knew it was going to be a nightmare. And wow. It was, I didn't enjoy it at all. Oh, I never enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I mean, they were lovely people that I was working with. Colin Fiore was playing Iago and he and I had worked together a lot.
So that's good. So you had that, at least you had that to work with on
yeah,
stage.
Yeah, that's right. He was really great. And I mean, everybody was terrific in it, except me.
But that's great though. That's a wonderful illustration of if you haven't got you, so you knew the lines, but
yeah, sure. I knew the lines. I knew the moves. I knew everything except what it meant to kill somebody.
Yeah. Okay. And you also teach. So you've taught at the National Theatre School and here in George Brown.
Yeah.
And talk a bit about your process as a teacher, because teaching acting is kind of one of the most, well, I mean, I had some acting teachers. Some were good and some were bad. And I shouldn't say some were good and some were bad. It's more some of them spoke to me and some of them didn't,
Yeah.
Because they were you can produce good results so many different ways.
Yeah. Well, I've had some really great acting teachers in my time. Amongst them, Douglas Rain and Louis Spritzer, who is our voice teacher, and Robin Phillips. And what they all talked about was the stuff that we've been talking about, which is just, I remember Robin saying over and over, I would be doing a scene. I was lucky enough to play Hamlet when Robin directed it. And I had a scene with Dominique Blythe, who was playing Gertrude. He said, just talk to her. Just talk to her. Meaning, don't shout, don't be hysterical, don't be dramatic, don't show me something. Trust the play and have a conversation. Just talk to her and let the words do it. And that's a big part of what it is to me to teach young actors, is to trust the play that they're doing. And don't think this is about you, because it ain't. It's about the play. It's about the story. It's about that person that the author wrote and the dilemma that she has at that moment.
How do you make it sound so simple?
I know.
But as an instructor, how do you work? How do you massage that? How do you actually?
The big thing about acting is that it's not just about the words you're speaking. It's about what you're hearing. What has happened today in the way we teach acting? We teach acting in terms of what they call verbing. So I am cajoling, I am caressing, I am choking, I am whatever.
What's the action verb?
Yeah, it's all action. It's all about action. It's all about doing something to somebody. But half of acting is what you hear. And and how you react, and that you are affected by what you hear. That's what a young actor needs to hear, what they need to know about. It's about your ability to take in. And that's the first thing that goes in any performance, is the ability to listen, because you've heard it so many times, you don't actually need to hear it. You know that as soon as she says wagon, your line is, you come in with an exclamation and yell at her about whatever, you know.
Now, is that actually a technique? Or not a technique? Is that a sort of a movement? Verbing? I hadn't heard that before.
Yeah. People talk about verbing. They arrive with their script and a column, and in that column, they write down the verb that is appropriate for the speech. And that's a useful tool, but it's only a tool, and it's only useful when you're stuck. Because most actors will act fairly well just instinctively. They'll read and they'll think, oh my God, how could she do that? And they'll respond accordingly. It's when you don't respond accordingly, it's when you don't understand what's written, that you say, okay, so what are you doing to that person? That's when you want to take things apart.
Right.
I always talk about when your car doesn't start in the winter, you go out and you try to start your car and it doesn't start. You don't go change the tires.
No.
You have to figure out why it didn't start. Is the battery dead? Is there gas in the car? What's the problem? And then you try to solve the specific problem, but you don't paint the car in the middle of winter just because it didn't start. That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. And it's internal. It's all internal at that moment.
Yeah, that's it.
It's all where have I got to be? What am I going to miss? It's all about the future, because you're walking into the car with a goal to be somewhere.
Yeah.
And now that's severed. Wild. Now I'm going through my acting and I'm going, how come I was never a better actor? I seem to understand this. I was terrible. I was a good character actor because I have a sense of humor and I play. That's right. What I do.
It should be play.
Well, that's true. That's true. I suppose. Anyway, this has just been, it's so good talking to you. I feel like every young actor should spend time with you. Seriously. You have so much to offer and such a wealth of knowledge. And are you going to be doing any teaching in the near future?
Not that I know of.
Yeah. No.
But
yeah.
If people ask me to teach, I'm always open to that.
Oh, that's interesting.
I like to teach.
Yeah.
I like working with people.
Cool. Well, Joseph, thank you so much for taking the time in the library here at Soul Pepper. And I'm excited to see you at Stratford in the summer. And, I really want to see you do Death of a Salesman.
Many thanks.
Okay.
Well, there you go, Mr. Joseph Siegler. It was such an honor, actually, to meet him, and a pleasure to spend that time with him in the library over at Soul Pepper. I just wanted to give you the heads up on that organization. We were talking about Soul Pepper's A Christmas Carol, and at the end of the show, Joseph mentions an organization, and they collect money for that organization. It's called The Stop, and they strive to increase access to healthy food while maintaining dignity, building health and community, and challenging inequality. Check them out at thestop.org. And go see The Last Wife. I did. It closes February 11th. It's fabulous. It's at the Young Center for the Performing Arts in Toronto's Distillery District. Hey, thanks so much for listening to the podcast. Don't miss another episode. Just subscribe on iTunes. It's super easy. Search the iTunes store for The Inadequate Life. Then hit subscribe. That way, you'll never miss an episode, like the next one featuring my interview with Sandra Shamus, currently on stage at Harbourfront in her new show, The Big What Now. Hey, the Toronto Star gave it 3.5 stars out of 4. I'm hopefully going to see it next week. I'm psyched. That's next week. She'll be on the podcast next week, The Inadequate Life, a podcast about the creative process and people whose lives depend upon it. I'm Keith Tomasek. Thanks for listening.